This is David.
You don't put that on my tombstone?
You don't put it on my tombstone?
No way.
Thank you, Wayne. Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And before I get started this morning, don't applaud me, applaud God. Before I get started this morning, there's a very, very tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous here at this meeting this morning. Not only a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous, loves AA with every fiber of her being, and a tremendous lady. And on April the 12th, she celebrated her 15th year birthday. And so, Faye, if you'll come up, we've got a little token for you. Get up here and make a little 10-minute talk.
Oh, no, I'm not gonna get up there.
But I ain't got enough time to tell everybody how smart I am. Thank you. My role today will be to share AA's experience and this member of Alcoholics Anonymous experience in our 12 tradition. We all have to remind each other no matter what role we have in AA, whether it's our own personal stories, are the steps, are the traditions, are the concepts, are service, or whatever it is in AA, that no human being speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. No one has that right, no one has that authority, and no one certainly has not been so designated, because we're only asked to share our experiences and not our opinions, because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker. And in some instances, to physically kill people. None of us have a license in AA to monkey with anybody's emotions, their heads, their feelings, their marriage relationships, unmarried relationships, live in, live out. Doesn't make a doggone bit of difference. We only have one story to tell, and that's our own. And so, as a result of it, you know, you hear this read all the time in AA, perhaps more so than you do a portion of Chapter 5, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other and may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism, which is nothing but a combination of Tradition 1 and Tradition 5. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking, Tradition 3. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, Tradition 7. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, Tradition 6. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes, Tradition 10. Our primary purpose and the only reason that AA is in business and the only reason that we are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is our primary purpose, is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, which is nothing but Tradition 5. You know, every member of AA, or every alcoholic, rather, a problem drinker, or whatever you want to call yourself when you get here, we're automatically given three gifts or three legacies. The legacy of recovery, the legacy of unity, and the legacy of service. And this was not so when Alcoholics Anonymous first got started. We only had one gift, and that was the gift of recovery. But as AA began to mushroom and grow, and AA, you know, and they were dragging everything and everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to get it to grow prematurely. People with just, they even looked at a bottle. They brought them into AA. You know, well, if you drank, you'd be one, you know. And it reminds me of a Big Book meeting that I've been chairing for over 25 years, and a lady came in one night, and it's the custom of the group that we call on everyone to comment. And she came in late, and she didn't hear that it was a closed meeting for alcoholics only. And so, you know, a nice lady. And so she held her hand up, and I said, yes. And she said, well, I'm not an alcoholic. But if I drank, I'd be one. And I looked at her and said, honey, if my mama would have had steel wheels, she'd have been a locomotive. And she says, no one's ever explained that to me before, you know. Yeah. I said, are you married to, live with, love one? She says, yep. I said, well, we've got a cooperating fellowship called Al-Anon. And so, as a result of it, the three legacies that were given, as I said, they began to mushroom. And in the middle 40s, whole groups were closing. They were dragging everybody and everything into Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to make alcoholics out of non-alcoholics so they qualify to be members of AA. Not by feeding them alcohol, but convincing them. And so as a result of it, a lot of the drunks were getting scared, and they went to Bill and said, Bill, do something. Bill, do something. So Bill sat down and wrote 12 more spiritual principles, which we now know as our 12 traditions. And so as a result of it, and we call that the second legacy of unity. And very implicitly throughout AA's traditions is the admission that our fellowship has its defects. Now, that's not hard to understand, because we're composed of 100% defects. There are no well folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're all the same. We're a society of equals. We admit that we not only have character defects as a society, but that these defects threaten us continuously. So our traditions are a guide as a result of bitter experience, and we have to remember our traditions were not written because of our good behavior. They were written because of our bad behavior. And they're a guide to better ways of working and living, and they're also the medicine for our various group sicknesses. And don't think groups don't get sick. Whole groups get drunk. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a group. They only had about 13 members in it, and they're all men. And they got a call from a gal out in a tourist court. Now, that's what you used to call them in those days. And she was drunk. And she'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she heard about this man that was sober in AA, and so she contacted him, and they had a meeting. Well, they had a problem. They didn't have any women that were sober in AA to go 12-step this gal. So one of the gallant blades decides he's going to 12-step her. Well, 2 days later, he hadn't shown back up. So they sent another member of the group to check on him and the gal, and they found them both drunk. Well, the second one that went out to check on the first one, he didn't come back. So they sent a third member of the group out there, and he found three of them drunk. The third one didn't come back, and this went on and on and on, and finally they only had one sober member left in the group. And he got lonesome telling himself his own story every night. So he decided, well, I'll go look on him. He went out there, found them all drunk. He said, well, they're all drunk. I might as well get drunk. And the whole group got drunk, and the whole group and that gal got sober, although she's not the longest continuous sober lady, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's one of the early ones. And they started all over again. And so the 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony. What AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight at our many individual defects. For by practical application, they ask for personal as well as group sacrifice, and that's the toughest thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. An A group is judged by the quality of the recovery in the members of that group. And that's the toughest thing, to put the common welfare first. Because the traditions simply request and ask us to never use the A name for any personal power or distinction or money. The traditions guarantee the equality of all members and the independence of all groups. As I said before, there are no second-rate members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are a society of equals. And if we'll listen to the stories and quit worrying about the differences, we all say the same thing. We couldn't stay sober, we couldn't stay drunk, we couldn't kill ourselves, we couldn't stay alive. And after we get into Alcoholics Anonymous, then we find we're truly a society of equals because we're all spiritually ill. And our reprieve is a daily reprieve contingent upon our maintenance of our spiritual condition one day at a time. And as a result of it, and also the independence of all groups. And that's so vital in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because AA allows every one of us as individually and collectively in our group the freedom to be ourselves as we are and the freedom to make our mistakes. If we hadn't made our mistakes, we never would be sitting in these chairs today. Period. Because that's where our great strength lies. Because the traditions just simply remind us how we may best relate ourselves to each other and to the world in which we live. They indicate how we can best function in harmony as a great whole and for the sake of the welfare of the entire society of Alcoholics Anonymous. The traditions just simply request that every member, every group, every district, every area, every region, every country in Alcoholics Anonymous shall lay aside all desires, ambitions, and unwanted actions that could bring serious division among us and lose for us the thing that we need so much, and that is the confidence of the world at large, because it is from the outside world that we get our referrals and we get our members. And there are hundreds of thousands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and there are hundreds of thousands that have been before us, and there are God knows how many hundreds of thousands that will come. Do not realize the confidence that the world at large has for Alcoholics Anonymous, for the principles of AA, not necessarily for some of us individual members, because they realize what the heads of state, educators, religion, in the business world, no matter what facet of life that we have, that they admire the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because, and you know, and when I begin to talk about traditions, I like to talk about our actual experiences that brought all this about. And, you know, they don't realize what the heads of state think about us. They certainly don't. You know, Russia has always had a tremendous problem with alcohol. And when Gorbachev became premier, a very liberal-minded human being, and he realized the seriousness of the problem of alcohol in Russia. And meanwhile, Ed got starting over there behind the Iron Curtain, and there was serious concern because when they began to read the steps, they saw that word God, and they began to run up the wall backwards on each other. And so they didn't know what this deal was, whether it was subversive against communism or what. Well, Russia's always had diplomatic relations with the Baltic countries, and it's real simple. Because in order to get to the North Sea, they have to go through the waters of those countries, in other words, get their ships and their submarines out. So they've always had diplomatic relations with the Baltic countries. And they found out that they're going to have an AA convention there, a national convention in Finland, in Helsinki. And so they contacted the government of Finland and wanted to know if some members of the Russian Politburo could come to the convention. And they said, yes, they could come. It was open. However, they could not participate because they were not members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they went. And they stayed for the entire convention. They got back to Moscow and they were asked, what is this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous? And they said, it's the darndest thing in the world that we ever witnessed or heard. Well, what's that? He said, you know, those people say that if you don't take the first drink of alcohol one day at a time, there's no way you can get drunk. They said, unbelievable. Then they said, well, who pays for it? He said, you won't believe this either. That bunch is self-supporting through their own contribution. They said, you mean the government doesn't have to pay for it? No. They don't have fundraising drives and out and stuff? No. Then they said, can it work here in Russia? They said, we believe very well. So how would it work? He said, well, he said, it's simple. You want to be a sober communist, you want to be a drunk communist. And you say, well, what about God? Well, I'll tell you, AA had a chance to blow itself out of the tub when it got started by trying to define the God in the second step. In the second step, it doesn't even name it. Believing in a power greater than themselves. Period. But in AA, we know who in time that there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Of course, God ain't been lost. They got one of them coffins over there, you know. I call them coffins. He said, the big book comes alive. I never knew it died. No. And so, as a result, and so as it began to spread behind the Iron Curtain, you know. And also, you know, they have a World Service meeting every 2 years. And every other 2 years, it's outside the continental limits of North America. And this particular year, they had it in San Juan del Rio, Mexico. And they send delegates from all over the world who have general service structures, not necessarily the conference, but also reprint and translate our copyright material. And so our general manager at the time, Bob P., got a long-distance call from the two delegates from South Africa. And they said they could not come to the World Service meeting because Mexico had severed diplomatic relations with Mexico. And while this is going on, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was up visiting the archives, and he came down to say hello to Bob. Bob's door to his office was always open. And Bob saw him and motioned him, told him to have a seat on the couch there in his office so he could hear Bob's end of the conversation, but he didn't know what the conversation was on the other end of the line. And after Bob hung up, he turned to him and said, "Well, I guess you won't know what that's all about." And he explained to them how the two delegates called from South Africa. They couldn't come to the World Service meeting because Mexico had severed diplomatic relations with Mexico. Well, this particular member went back to his job. At that time, he was the second highest ranked full-paid employee of the United Nations. He went back, but he didn't go to his office. He went directly to the office of the ambassador from Mexico to the United Nations. And he walked in unannounced. And he says, "I need to talk with you." He says, "You know, for some way or other, you found out that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you called me in this very office one day and you were crying that y'all had a son that was a total embarrassment to not only you and your wife and the family, but also to the country in which you represent. That he was drunk, and he was on everything in this God's world. He thought he was Batman. He was trying to fly off the top of the Empire State Building. Now, I didn't ask you if he's black or white. I didn't ask you if he's polka dot or if he's a leper. I didn't ask you what you believe in, what you don't believe in. I didn't ask you even what he was on. He said, where do you think we can find him and what's his name? And we found him. And today, by God's grace, he is not only a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but a very productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he is no longer a menace to your family, nor to your country, or to the people in the United States or any place else that he is. There goes. Now, you know that AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. And they're getting ready to have the World Service meeting in your country. And the delegates from South Africa can't come because y'all have severed diplomatic relations with them because of the black and the white situation. Now, I want you to get on the phone. And I want you to call what corresponds to our Secretary of State. And you explain the situation and get him in there. He said, wait a minute. This will call for a presidential order. It may even call for their ruling body to meet. He said, I don't care what it calls for. I'm not going to leave your office till you put that call through. So he called him. And he got a hold of what corresponds to our Secretary of State down there. He said, wait a minute here. Wait a minute here. This is a matter that we talked over with the president. We'll go talk to the president. So they went to the president, and Portillo was the president at the time, and he said, wait a minute, wait a minute. He picked up the phone, and he called his best friend, Rodolfo, an international, famous international lawyer. He said, Rodolfo, why didn't you tell me that Mexico is going to be host to the most prestigious meeting that we can ever have in Mexico? He says, you know what I think about Alcoholics Anonymous? It's the only decent thing we've got in Mexico. Their people help each other. They don't got their hand out begging the government for money. They're not on the street selling flowers and brooms and hot tamales and everything else. No. They're a credit to Mexico. It's a shame the entire population of Mexico can't live by those principles. Why didn't you tell me? And Rodolfo explained to him that, if you remember, that's when they closed the banks in Mexico. They devaluated the peso. They had troops running around all over Mexico. And he said, I didn't want to bother you in your times of political turmoil. He said, hang up. Hickard told his Secretary of State, he said, you call the General Service Office in New York City, Alcoholics Anonymous. You tell them to contact those two delegates from South Africa. And you tell them to come through Holland and clear immigration and customs in Amsterdam. That we have diplomatic relations with Holland and fly directly to Mexico City, and they will not have any trouble getting into Mexico City, no trouble while they're here, and will have no trouble leaving. And he said, that is a presidential order. And that's how they got there. Now, I'm going to talk about Rudolfo for a few moments. You know, God has it in his mysterious ways and wonders to perform. Rudolfo attended an international lawyers meeting in London many years ago. He sat next to a gentleman from the United States. The gentleman from the United States asked him, he says, are you having supper tonight with anyone? He says, no. He said, how would you like to have dinner with me? They did. And the next thing you know, Rudolfo found himself and his newfound friend sitting in an open AA meeting in London. After the meeting was over with, the gentleman from the lawyer from the United States said, how do you like this? He said, this is the most amazing thing I've ever sat through. Can we go to another one? They're more interested in them lawyer meetings we're going to. He said, sure. So they went to three straight open AA meetings. And when the convention disbanded at the weekend, the lawyer from Mexico asked his newfound friend, he said, when I get back to Mexico City, what can I do as a non-alcoholic to cooperate with this tremendous thing and experience that I've been through this week with Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, when you get back, why don't you ask him? So he called him up. And when he did, why, that's the most prestigious man that ever called Alcoholics Anonymous, their central office. They thought they had a live one, didn't realize he was a non-alcoholic. And he said, how, what can I do to cooperate with you? And they later put him on as a trustee. And he was later elected chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous Mexico. He still is the chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the gentleman from the United States was also a world-famous international lawyer and a banker by the name of Bernard Smith. Bernard Smith is a gentleman, the lawyer, who wrote the conference charter for our General Service Conference. Also for the bylaws and the incorporation of the General Service Board, AAWS, and the Grapevine, a tremendous human being, a non-alcoholic. And you know, you're talking about what the heads of state think. Many, many years ago, when the former president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, was alive, and when the United Nations moved from San Francisco to New York City, the present site, Herbert Hoover was asked to make a very important policy talk at the United Nations. And he went. And right in the middle of his talk, he stopped and he made a 180-degree turn. And he says, you know, if the world would live by the most perfect principles that has come to his attention in all of his long span of living, that this would be the finest world that God would ever know. And the principles he said I'm referring to are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's no known documentation that Herbert Hoover or any of his blood kin or emotionally attached had ever been or were members of Alcoholics Anonymous or any of the our cooperating fellowships of Al-Anon, Alateen. And for a number of years, members of AA, when they'd hear this, said, oh, that's just drunks making up stories. Well, all you have to do is read one of the early conferences, and Bill talks about it. And I've been very, very fortunate over the periods of years involved in all facets of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing special on my part. I just happen to be at the right place at the right time. Sponsored by some tremendous members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I've been doing a little research for the board and for several other things in AA. It was nothing, no big deal. And I managed to get a hold of the invitation list that was sent out to all of John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s friends when he gave that wonderful dinner for Alcoholics Anonymous in February of 1940 at the Union Club. And so the drunks had it, and what they would do, they would go on after each name, and they'd put little remarks after them. Because really, the drunks were going to take advantage of Rockefeller's friends by hustling them for a couple of $1 million. And that was the real reason that they wanted that dinner, because they were all busted. And I haven't seen an alcoholic yet that said, if I had enough money, all my troubles would be free, particularly somebody else's money. And so, as a result, they wrote little notes. This one is tight. This one is a prohibitionist. This one is loose with his pocketbook. This one is crazy. But right after one name was these words, perhaps Herbert Hoover's best personal friend. Well, if you're active in AA, and you got a lot of spies if you sponsor. And so there's a gal in our group. She went to New York City, and she began to work in the sales department of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Well, after Herbert Hoover left the presidency of the United States and he moved to New York City, he lived in what they call the Towers of the Waldorf Hotel there in New York City. And the Towers is very, very exclusive with its own security and its own elevators and its own entrance, period. And so, and I knew that he had lived there. And so I got a hold of this gal in the sales department, and I said, can you look up the old records and see? And I gave her the name of Herbert Hoover's best personal friend. And she called me about a week later. They not only lived on the same floor, but they were in adjacent suites. And that's where he found out about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, to go back to the story, because television in those days was in its infancy, and the radio and the newsprint was the most popular transmission of media, and the radio was on, and when the two words Alcoholics Anonymous came out on the radio, there were a bunch of members of AA sitting around doing nothing, you know? You know, doing nothing. You know, buying airlines, building airports, bottling water, and all this other stuff in this God's world. And when they'd leave, they'd say, oh, by the way, loan me a couple of bucks for some cigarettes, you know, dealing in millions and having no money whatsoever. But when the two words Alcoholics Anonymous came out on the, blared out on the radio, their ears stuck up just like jackasses eating briar, you know. And they said, by God, listen to that man. He's talking about us. He ain't a member of us. We're the only ones that know anything about AA. We're going to rule the world. Let's go up and tell Bill. Well, when Bill was alive, everybody went up to see Bill. So they borrowed somebody else's car. They borrowed some money to put gas in the car and cigarettes and coffee and off to go up to Bedford Hills. And they got up to Bedford Hills, and they come up here. Here's the house, and here's the garage, and there's a knoll up there with a house with a big A-frame window. And I've sat there, and Harlan talked about sitting at Bill's desk. I sat there before he got sober. And anyway, and I'm up there, and I'm looking out this picture window, and I knew exactly where Bill got all of his inspiration and his writing about our kind of people, because he's sitting out there watching them squirrels eating nuts. That's what. Now, he talked about that stuff he was going to, thought about stealing it. I did one time.
Yeah.
Still got that pamphlet. I told Lois about it many years later. Said, that's all right, honey. It's somebody else's copy, or they'd have taken it anyway. And she'd at least pass it on, you know. Well, I ain't passed it yet. I'll probably give it to Bob and Faye, and they put it up in one of them boxes in there that they won't even let you touch, you know. They make it hard to go in that archive. You can't smoke, you can't drink, you can't eat. You got to sign your name, fingerprint, and every doggone thing else. You know, all for the good of AA, of course, you know. And so as a result, you know, and so they built. And they walked in there, and when they saw Bill, their eyes were as big as Coca-Cola bottle bottoms. They said, Bill, you won't believe this. But old Herbert, AA's best friend, he said, old Herbert who? He said, well, Herbert Hoover. Bill said, I didn't know he was AA's best friend, and at that time, Bill really didn't know. And so as a result of it, well, what did he say? He said, Bill, he was down at the United Nations. Now, the story had changed from the time them drunks left downtown Manhattan. They got up to Bedford Hills. You have to remember about our kind of people. We do not lie. We embellish a lot. We color it up, but we do not lie. And to give you a perfect example of that, I happened to be in a hotel suite in 1968. And Bill was on the floor, And I'll get to talk about meeting Bill. Bill's on the floor. Bill always likes to sit on the floor with his back to the wall and cross them old legs and long turkey neck. And he was telling some wild story about AA way back there when God Almighty, when AA was a lot in here at this conference, wasn't even born yet, you know. And he's talking about all that doggone stuff. And Lois was sitting in the chair next to him. And Lois tapped him on the shoulder. He said, "Now, Bill, that's not the way it was." And he looked up there and he said, "But, honey, that's the way I remembered it." And so even Bill got excited. Oh, my God, he's got it. And he said, the story had changed. He said, "What did he say?" He said, "The United Nations better live by the principles of AA or the world's going you know where." And I said, Bill was a real drunk. Now, I was 5.5 months sober. And I was unemployable and unemployed, didn't have any money, didn't have any clothes, and a former delegate, who was a delegate on panel 3, wanted to go back up to the New York office and talk with the old secretary before he died, and it just happened to be Bill's 33rd sobriety birthday. And he wanted to know if I'd go. Well, I didn't have any money. So he bought me one of them Taiwan knit suits, the kind that you get out in about a 2-inch rain and you shrink for about 2 sizes. And he bought me 2 sets of nylon drawers, the kind you wear one and drip, dry, and wash and hang it over the shower curtain when it dries at night. 2 pairs of nylon black socks and an old tie, and I had a pair of beat up old alligator brown shoes, and I hand sewed them myself and took kids' Crayolas and covered the holes up. And he bought me a ticket, and he said, "Now, this is a gift. I ain't loaning you nothing. Because if I loan you something and you don't pay it back, I'm liable to get a resentment." Somewhere along the line, I wrote a check somewhere, owed somebody some money. I'm just repaying the debt. And years later, and he said, "And when you get sober and you get financially able, you do the same." And thank God I was able to a few years later. So we go to New York City, and we go down to the old office, and walk in there, and met the secretaries, and Hazel said, "Would you like to meet Bill?" And here I'm 5.5 months sober. I'm going to the head of the mountain, you know. And that's right when the AA way of life, or as Bill sees it, came out that particular month in October 1967. And Bill was in there autographing some copies because it's Bill's birthday. It's a huge dinner. And they come from all over everywhere, Europe and Central and South America and Canada and some from the Far East and the United States, about 3,000 or 4,000 folks. And I went in there, and there Bill was, and his secretary's Nell Wing. And he said, "Nell, now leave. This is going to be a closed meeting of Alcoholics Only." And Nell left, and he looked at me, and he said, "Son, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Dallas, Texas." He said, "How long you been sober?" And I told him, 5.5 months. He said, "What group in Dallas, Texas?" And I said, "Suburban group." And God, his eyes just glowed, because that was the bunch that he sent his sponsor and friend down to try to get Ebby to get him sober. And he ended up in Cersei's drying out joint. And he ended up out there in West Texas on a ranch, and he drove old Ralph and Mary Lee crazy because he'd get over in Mexico and he loved to drink ale. And he'd get him out of the Mexican jails all the time and then shipped him back to Dallas. And one of the longest periods of stretches of sobriety, although it was intermittent, that he was able to stay sober around the bunch from the Suburban Group in Dallas, Texas. Then he asked me, and one particular member who's a kind of a hustler is always trying to impress somebody by trying to send in more money to the General Service Office as a yearly contribution than any group, even if he had to practically hit you on the head to get a few bucks out of you. And it was an ego thing. And so he said, "How's so-and-so?" And I said, "I don't like him, and I hate him." Because my first AA meeting was on the last Sunday of August of 1950. And I went drunk and left the meeting and got drunker and came back in. And I started a fight with this fella and hit him and I broke his nose. And I got thrown out of that group. And so as a result of it, I don't like him. And Bill gave me the finest spiritual experience that's ever been my privilege and pleasure to receive. He said, "Son, let me tell you something. After bitter years of experience, going through some of the things in your mind about members of Alcoholics Anonymous, not liking them." And he said, "I found out that always look for whatever little good is in any human being and never fear their worst. That is the greatest spiritual experience passed on to me that I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Period. And so, meanwhile, he's talking. Now, Bill was a real drunk. He was a real drunk. And Bill never did stop smoking. He just quit buying, that's all. And when Bill smoked, he smoked Picayune cigarettes. And when he had a real alcoholic cigarette cough. It started his toenails and come all the way up, and then have an aftershock as it tapered off. And we're sitting in there, and pretty soon we heard clop, clop, clop of heels. And the door to Bill's office was open, and Bill could see who's coming down the hall. My back wasn't, I couldn't see. And Bill sticks that long turkey neck out, and we turned around, and this is not when the miniskirts came in, but right after the micro minis came in. And here come clopping down the hall in this micro mini with this beautiful blue-eyed blonde from California that had come in for Bill's dinner, about 5'2", well enamored. And when she walked, everything on the outside of her and inside of her jiggled, you know. And Bill's just from the front to the back. And she walked by, and he turned to me, and he looked at me, and he said, "Son, AA is in good hands." And right there and then, I found out our co-founder was a human being, that he wasn't a frozen ice cube, and he certainly wasn't an icon or an idol or anything else, you know, yeah. But to go back to the story, and so, you know, and they're talking about you know, and the drunk said, "Now, Bill, we're going to run the United Nations." Now, can't you see a bunch of alcoholics running the United Nations, members of AA? You turn on your television set in the morning, and this blocked-out face comes on and says, "Good morning, world. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we're down here at the United Nations this morning, and we're going to open up this session with a moment of silence, and we're going to follow it with a serenity prayer. And for you civilians out there that do not know the serenity prayer, the words will come along the bottom of the screen, and you can say it with it. Then after that, open every meeting, we read a portion of Chapter 5, how this deal works. And the ambassador from Iran is still having a tough time understanding how this thing works, and we're going to ask him to read it one more time. And after that, they're going to the executive and general sessions, and the topic for discussion among the nations today will be honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And we're going to ask you to return to your television sets at 5 o'clock this afternoon for a very important announcement, because we understand from a very reliable source that the ambassador from Iraq is going to take his fifth step with the ambassador from the United States. And then Bill got inside, and Bill said, "Hey, wait a minute, boys, wait a minute, wait a minute." At that time, they estimated there are 9.5, maybe 10 million drunks in the world. Bill said, "No, we're not all things for all people. Only our kind. And if you want to know what we are, there it is right behind me. One alcoholic talking to another. Period. And there ain't one way to become an alcoholic, and that is to drink some of that juice and then fit our descriptions." You know, AA has no definition of alcoholism. It has descriptions of an alcoholic. AA doesn't even call it a disease. They call it a malady. Yeah, a malady. Yeah, one alcoholic talking to another. And that brought them all down to the level. I doubt if very, very few members of Alcoholics Anonymous have ever known or know that the most successful food relief drive that's ever been conducted in this world was the Greek relief fund and drive many, many years ago. And the reason that it was so successful is because the gentleman who advised them about it was a member of AA, and they used the principles of our traditions, our common welfare. Period. Period. And so the 12 conditions, you see, because if not, we'll lose the confidence of the world at large. So the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous stand as a sacrificial character of our life together. And it's the greatest force of unity that we know about. This brings us to tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Now, we can knock this tradition out very quick. Common problem, common solution, common recovery, common father. But if it's not the oneness of one, then it is not our common welfare. Now, probably no society in this world sets a higher value on the personal welfare of the individual members than does Alcoholics Anonymous. We always need to remember that Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the precious few society in the world that's totally free. There are no dues. There are no fees. You can come. You can go. You can stay. We can leave. No one can force anybody to do anything. Can't force anybody to believe anything. Don't have to. No. Total freedom. And we can't handle it. The freedom is the good is the enemy of the best. But long ago, AA found out that our common welfare had to come first, because without it, there could be very personal, little personal welfare. Our individual sobriety depends upon the group, and the group depends upon us. That's what you call live and let live. And we soon learn in AA, some of us the hard way, that unless we curb our individual desires and ambitions, we can damage what? The unity of the group. You'd be surprised how many members of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and have been in AA over 5 years, have never seen a wet, wet, sloppy drunk brought to his first AA meeting. Now, if you want your group to perk up, you bring one of them drunks to the meeting. Let them fall down and throw up on the rug. Then you find out what the rug is all about, you know. And our group, we still bring them in. We put them on the front row. We call that hopeless row. And we put one on either side of them so they can't jump sideways. Then we'll put a sober member back behind them so if they fall backwards, they won't hit their head on the floor. And then we get the fattest, ugliest, meanest-looking member of the group, man or woman. Put them in a chair facing that drunk so they can't jump out. Then we find out, we shift gears. We find out, who's talking tonight? Oh, no. Nah, they're too religious. We got a wet, wet drunk in here. Get somebody to talk about drinking alcohol. And we get one of them kind of tells one of them barn-burning stories, you know, that by God they drank and shot the police and threw their wife and their girlfriend out of the same window at the same time and took the cat and whirled it around the head by the tail and threw it in the fireplace. And then he said, and you know, after 45 years of drinking, I woke up one morning and realized I have a little bitty problem with alcohol. Now, what's happened to that wet, wet drunk on the front row? When he starts talking about drinking, that wet, wet drunk will say, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know nothing about drinking. Let me tell you. Somebody says, shut up. You know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell him, shut up? Make me. Meanwhile, always back in the meeting, there'll be one of them 30-day wonders, you know. Now, you can't talk to that brother drunk like that. That's one of God's kids. Who said that? I said that. How long you been sober? 30 days. Shut up. Now, there are a lot of 30-day wonders in AA today. Not all of them. You can't talk to them that way. You talk to them that way, you know what to tell you? Don't you talk to me that way. I'm going back and tell my counselor, you know. Yeah. Well, what's happened to that wet drunk on the front row? That wet drunk is in hog heaven. Here are a bunch of people who are absolutely excited and thrilled because he is drunk, because he is dirty, and flies are buzzing about him, and they're arguing about how best to take care of him when he just came from a whole bunch out there that were fussing at him because he is drunk. And folks, that's the difference between them out there and us in here. And when we start letting them out there run our business in here, we're in serious trouble. Let's always remember, when we tried to run their business out there where they told us to go, and it certainly wasn't the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, yeah. If we can just remember that, yeah. And so, you know, and sometimes you have to ask them to leave. They get violent. Sometimes you ask them to leave. Sometimes you have to call the police. I was in a group one night, and they called the police. Oh, my God. Got all excited, though. You can't call the police anonymity. And the only ones that were excited in the group about calling the police and mad about it are the ones still had some outstanding warrants against them, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know of a better way to inform the police where your group meets. Period. And then they'll start bringing them wet drunks to your group. They don't want to mess with them down in jail. Not today with the Supreme Court and everything else. You look at a prisoner wrong, he'll sue you. You know, they'd rather us get mess with them, you know. And we just love them. But the problem in today in AA, and this is not critical of the members that we have, please. As there many, many of our members do not know how to sit with and work with a wet drunk. They get scared. There's one night I'm coming to the meeting, Big Book meeting, and there was the paramedics, and there was a squad car with two policemen, and there was a fire truck. And what happened? The 6 o'clock meeting, we call that the sicko meeting. They come out there, and they see this wet, wet drunk, and he's laying in the curb, and he's got a pint of Everclear alcohol in his coat. So they get all exercise running and call the 911 number. And here comes the paramedics and everything, and I'm coming up the sidewalk, and one of the policemen looks at me and says, "Look at that. What do you want to do with him?" I said, "Heck, our sign just fell down, that's all." I said, "Listen, how do you think you can ever become a member of AA if you don't drink alcohol? Let us have him." It just so happened that I happened to be the sponsor of that policeman. So we took him in, and we put him, we got a little room in there, the way you can work with a wet drunk, and got orange juice and honey and milk and all them good things. And put him in this little room, and he passed out, and he had his head on the table. And after meetings over, he went and checked up on him, and there he, underneath the table, rolled up like a bowling ball. Said, "What are you going to do with him?" "Well, we're going to leave him." I said, "Now, I don't know." I said, "How many in here have ever sat up all night with a wet drunk?" "Well, I'm the only one who held my hand up." I said, "I'm going to go, and I'm going to change clothes, and I'm coming back, and you're in for an experience. And we're going to walk this drunk around the block. He's going to throw up on you. He's going to beg and scream and holler and everything else. And by God, we'll find out from whence we came." So I went home, and I was home, and my phone rang. The chairman of the group said, "Did you leave a wet, wet drunk in the group?" I said, "Sure did." "What are you going to do with him?" I said, "Have you ever sat up all night with a wet drunk?" "No." I said, "Well, you're invited to come." And so, we sat up with him all night. And it just so happens that we were concerned about the fact that he had been had a blow to the head because blood was coming out of his ears. We took him to the hospital. Thank God it wasn't serious. Yeah. And we had one wet drunk. We took him down to the Salvation Army. And the police have to admit him into this thing. So we took him in. No, the police have to admit him. And I had me my running bait, my bodyguard. He's a full-blooded Choctaw Indian from Oklahoma. And I said, "Joe, come here." I said, "Joe, you..." So we drug him and put him half out on the street and the other half the body on the curb. And I said, "Joe, there's a payphone down there. I'm going to call the police. And I'm going to tell them that I'm coming down this street. And we stop. There's a body halfway laying in the street. And I'm concerned as a taxpaying citizen that somebody will run over him and do serious harm to him. And after I call him, I'll give you the high sign. You come on." I called the police and I explained it to them. Hung up. Joe come running on. We hit around the corner. Here comes a squad car. They picked him up and took him right around the corner and admitted him to the Salvation Army. Now, let me tell you something. We're the greatest group of sober con artists in this world. It ain't how you get to AA. It's what we do after we get here. Period. Yeah. And so, that's only one aspect of the picture. When we get sober in AA, we begin to lose and throw off a small bits of our big ego, for we admit, "I can't handle alcohol, but I can't stay away from it on my own." Fine. But then we find there's still plenty of that ego with us. Sometimes it may lead us into taking other members' inventories and to gossip about their supposed shortcomings. "I guess I'm the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this meeting this morning is guilty of it." Or it may lure some into hogging discussion at every discussion meeting. How many times do we hear it in AA? "I quit going to that group. I quit going to those meetings. So-and-so is always chairing the meeting. He's reading the announcements. He's taking up the money. He's doing all the talking. He's taking everybody what to do, telling everybody how to make coffee, et cetera. I quit going to that meeting. Well, if it's happening in your group, you know how to end it. Simple. If we're asked to do anything, AA, and we turn it down, let's not gripe at the ones that are doing it. Because it has to get done. Period. Yeah. And when we slip in that spot a lot of times, well, you know, this is a selfish program, isn't it? And all the active misery of alcoholism, why shouldn't we indulge ourselves in some of this little harmless fun? And I believe we all know one of the reasons why we should not. Because the first self-indulgence of this kind is of immediate danger, for it threatens the individual's own sobriety. But far more serious, it threatens the very basis of our sobriety, the unity of the AA group. The unity of keeping the recovery program and talking about recovery as a result of a twofold illness of mind and body. That's AA's description of our kind of people. A twofold illness of mind and body. A mental obsession so powerful that condemned us to drink against our own will. And the physical nature of the illness condemned us to die if we continued to drink. Yeah. Because as a result of it, and another obstacle sometimes is that what we call that AA is a well-known triangle. Now you have to remember, you got human beings in AA. There ain't but three kinds of alcoholics to begin with. There's a sober alcoholic and a drinking alcoholic and a dead alcoholic. That's all. But in AA, we got two kinds. We got male and female, you know. And they'll sit there and, you know, and they'll hold hands, you know, and they go out and have ice cream, you know. And they've been here about 3 weeks and says, David, all I've ever wanted to have is a meaningful relationship with another human being. What do you think, David? And I said, you mean you want to have sex without falling in love? And that's all. And so they, you know, and particularly, and, you know, and they look at each other, you know, it just acts like kind of about when I was drinking in them bars, I'd go in there, and there's always ladies in the bars and gentlemen. And I'd go in, you know, and there's a lady sitting over there, and a bartender, buy that lady a drink. Bartender, take a drink over there. Where'd this come from? I didn't order it. The gentleman over there is buying it. I don't drink with strangers. And she darn near breaks the bartender's arm to keep from jerking that drink away. And she takes a sip and looks over and smiles. And I smile back. Another drink. And then you start playing musical chairs, you know. And she says, how come I've never met such a fine gentleman as you before? And I said, well, I've been thinking the same thing about you. She says, you married? Yeah, but, you know. Well, we're separate bedrooms, and when the children graduate high school, we're going to split. You two? Mm-hmm. How old is your children? Well, the boy is 3 and the girl's 2. You two? And about 3 hours later, you got 2 drunks with wet drawers going out the door to get married, you know. Well, now this spills over in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Yeah, and so as a result of it, and, you know, and sometimes I had violent explosions, you know. And the group I come in, they had a bunch of, they're getting good before they get well. And they had some Red Riding Hood and wolves in the group. And that bunch was very concerned because it was going to ruin their reputation. Well, you can't throw anybody out of an AA group if they're not violent and if they're sober. And so, but they wanted them out of there. So they didn't know what to do. So they sat down and wrote Bill a letter. Said, dear Bill, we've got these Red Riding Hood wolves in our group and they're ruining our reputation. Bill writes back, dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill. Well, Bill doesn't understand the seriousness of the situation. So they sat down and wrote him a more detailed letter. Bill sends a letter back. Dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill. Well, Bill really doesn't understand. So they wrote a real lurid letter. Put in stuff that they, you know, just imaginary and everything. It wasn't a question of what that bunch there was doing, was right or wrong. This bunch over here, it's not the way they wanted them to do it. And so they sent this letter to Bill, sent an airmail special delivery, certified receipt, return requested. The letter comes back and says, "Dear group, are they still staying sober? Love, Bill. Don't bother me anymore." Well, this bunch over here was so busy writing letters and figuring how to throw them out, when they finally looked over there, guess what? The situation had taken care of itself. And I'm so thankful that was shared with me in my first few days of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, which has meant to me that I've got all I can do to take care of my relationship with my Creator through the recovery program and the principles of AA, without sticking my nose in your business, and you've got all you can do to take care of your relationship with your Creator or power greater than yourself through the principles of AA, without sticking your nose in my business. And that's what you call live and let live. And you know, back in the early days, talking about women, and the best way I can describe the unity of this particular tradition and how it came about, they only had one group in New York City, the Manhattan group. And they had two atheists in there. One was not so violent, but one of them was. And he'd get up there and he'd scream and he'd holler when they talk about God. Now, this is, remember, before the Big Book was written. So because they spilled off the Oxford movement, they would read a portion from the book of James, maybe, or a portion of Emmett Fox's Sermon on the Mount. In other words, to get them into a spiritual feeling of God, or power greater himself. Well, the one that was violent, he'd stand up and he'd argue. He said, "I don't believe in God, and I'm just as sober as anybody in this group." And they used to have fist fights, and they couldn't hold a meeting, and it got so bad, the secretary would notify all the members of the group except him, and they'd move the meeting. Well, the problem was he'd find them, and they ran out of places to meet. They didn't know what to do. So his name was Jimmy Burwell. So they went to Bill and said, "Bill, we got to do something." He said, "Send Jimmy to me." So Jimmy goes to see Bill. Bill says, "Jimmy, Dr. Bob and myself, we're farming an automobile polish company, and we need somebody to go out on the road and sell it. It just so happens that Jimmy had the only asset in the group. He's the only one that had a car. It was an old Lincoln Zephyr. And a car in those days was very valuable, to go snatch drunks and take them to the nut house, or get them out of the nut house or to the jail or everything, and get them sober and bring them to me. And they were willing to get rid of that car just to have one meeting for an hour in total peace." So Jimmy went on the road as a sales manager of a one-man sales force to sell automobile polish that never was going to be manufactured. Just Bill just made it up, just to get him out. So he gets down to Philadelphia, 90 miles away, and he does what any sober member of AA needs to do if there's no group and no contact. He went and got him a wet drunk. And you know, that wet drunk took the bait and started a little group. And he used to meet in a hotel room in downtown Philadelphia. And they'd run a blurb in the newspaper. That was the first time that they'd done that, by starting our public information policy. They run a blurb in the newspaper. It said, "If you're having trouble with alcohol and you want to get fixed," it read more like a veterinarian's ad, "then come down to this hotel at this hour, period, and day of the week." Well, in comes this gal. Her name was Gladys. And she was drunk. And she was a farmer working vaudeville in a show dancing kick line. And she came in just boiled like 9 hours. Now, back in those days, when the AA group met, they closed the door and they have a guard on the outside of the meeting, and only real alcoholics could come into the meeting. Well, here comes old Gladys, just a weaving. He said, "What do you want?" She said, "I come here to get fixed." He said, "You go over there." "Well, what's over there?" He said, "Them others." "What do you mean, them others?" "Well, wives, girlfriends. I'm not one of those others. I got a problem with alcohol, and I come here to get fixed." He said, "You can't come in. You go over there. There ain't no women alcoholics." She said, "Are you calling me a liar? You're a bigger liar than me." And she took off one of her spiked heel pumps, and she got to beating on that drunk. He had him down on the floor, darn near half killing him in self-defense. He said, "Lady, if you want to get fixed that bad, you go in." The guard on that night at that meeting was none other than our co-founder's friend and sponsor, Ebby. Ebby later became Gladys' sponsor. Gladys got sober. Marty got sober, and then she went back to drinking. And right about the same time that Marty got sober the second time, here comes Gladys. So there's just a few minutes and seconds. Gladys moved to Dallas. When we got her, she wasn't so pretty. She didn't have any teeth, you know, and she had so many varicose veins you could read her legs like a road map, you know. But God, was she tremendous, 12-stepping those gals. She's another one of them picayune smokers. And she did, the coffee that we made in the group was never strong for her. She used to carry a big bottle of Instant with a tablespoon, and she'd pour 2 tablespoons in that and drink it boiling hot. And she and another gal in the group secretary, in our group, we've got over 2,000 members. 48% of our group are gals. Our gal. And when a gal comes in our group, we only have one thing to offer them, and that's recovery. We make darn sure that them wolves don't hang on them when they're brand new. You betcha. And we get gals to talk with them, walk in between them. Mm-hmm. You betcha. Because we're dealing in human lives. We really are. We're dealing in human lives. And so, as a result, you know, and so Gladys was a tremendous factor. But they found out long ago, you know, that sex wasn't going to break them up, you know. We find forces that threaten us in other ways. And that usually masquerade as righteous indignation. Pride, fear, and anger. They are the prime enemies of our common welfare. Because, you see, the purpose of A's traditional principles is to bring these things to the top and keep them there. Only then can our common welfare be served. Only then can A's unity become permanent. For the preservation of A's unity is not only life and death matter for us, but also for that alcoholic who is to come. Let's try not to forget we're in AA today for that drunk that's still out there, and for no other reason, period. And so now this brings us to tradition 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Now, this is utterly amazing about this particular tradition. If one reads the long form of the traditions, the second tradition in the short form is longer than the second tradition in the long form. And the reason for it is real simple. When our traditions were adopted in 1950 in Cleveland, and later on when our third legacy was adopted in St. Louis in 1955, and they changed the name of the old Alcoholic Foundation trustees to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the bylaws, they put the short form in so it wouldn't be so cumbersome. But it was Bernard Smith who went to Bill and says, "Look, Bill, one of the biggest problems that we're having is members of the board of trustees. They don't know us. They think we run Alcoholics." And before 1955, they did run Alcoholics Anonymous, period. Control of all of our monies and everything else. But when it was handed over to the members of AA, that was another story. He suggested to Bill, "We need to add a line to the second tradition." And Bill said, "What's that?" "That our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern." Now, the early AA members quickly recognized what we call in AA the power driver or a potential group wrecker. And he or she is still around. The member is always sure that he or she is always right. The member who is very happily ready to assume all the burdens of leadership, but will not give them up or share them, leave them alone. And we see it happen all the time in AA. You know, the older members of AA, and then as AA groups begin to grow and AA grow, the members begin to read the most dangerous literature you can read in AA, and that is the service manual. where it talks about rotation. You see, there's three things in AA take care of all AA's problems. That's alcohol, death, and rotation. It does the best job that you've ever seen in your life. And so as a result, you know, and they say, hey, wait a minute here. You've been running this group for 20 years. It says here you got to rotate. We're going to have an election. Well, old member, you know, his pride and his ego gets wounded. He said, we can't have that modern bunch running AA to come in here with skateboards, you know. Yeah, with the shirts open all the way down to the popo, you know. Yeah. Rings in their ears and their nose. Nah. Stripes of orange hair, red hair, green hair. We can't have that sleeping bag crowd in AA run our group. So the old member, he gets everybody he sponsors, and he said, look, we're going to have this election. And I want you to gather up everybody you sponsor in this group. And if you know some members of AA that they don't know that are members of AA in other groups, bring them in here. And we're going to vote. And I'm going to sit on the front row. And when I vote, I'm going to hold up my hand. And when I hold up my hand, I want you to hold up my hand. Yeah, you betcha. Now, when Bill traveled all over North America, literally promoting the traditions prior to 1950 when they were accepted in Cleveland, when he got to this tradition, the oldest sober member of the group, they had apoplexy. What do you mean a loving God is a group? No, I'm the group conscience. My group don't have a conscience. I'm the group conscience. By gosh, I got them all sober. I got them to smoking ready-rolled cigarettes off of Bugler. I got to put shoes on them. I went to talk to their mamas and their papas and their wives and their kids and everybody else. I went to court with them. I loaned them some money to get a little car, got them a job. If it wouldn't be for me, they wouldn't be sober and they wouldn't be alive and they wouldn't be in AA. I am the group conscience and I decide what it was. And later on, as I told you, we'll talk about rotation, you know. Because AA is both a democracy and our own co-founder Bill's word is benign anarchy. A group elects its own officers who have no power to order anybody to do anything. Now, isn't that something? What's the big deal if you elect the chairman of your group? It's no big honor to be known as the head sick. In AA, we want everybody to have the freedom to be the head sick. We don't want to have them to have no resemblance, you know. In most groups, most of the slate rotates out of office at the end of 6 months, and then new ones come in. If a group wants to be a part of worldwide AA service structure, then it elects a GSR for a two-year term corresponding with the area committee of the delegates' two-year term, and the GSRs, along with the district committee members and other voting area members of the area, elect a delegate from the area to the annual general service conference. And this conference is about as close as approximation of government that they had because it does produce opinions on important matters of policy. And so, but neither the conference nor the board of trustees can give orders to any group, any place, or even to any members. And then you say, well, who's in charge around here? Well, AA is a spiritual movement, and so the ultimate authority is the spiritual concept of the group conscience. Its voice is heard when a well-informed group gathers to arrive at a decision. Minority ideas in AA get very thoughtful attention, or should, because in most instances in time, the minority becomes the majority. Now, what about that annoying character who always says he's right? Better listen. Maybe just this once, he or she is right. If he or she is wrong, if they will, if they remember the first tradition as well as the second tradition about unity, and God runs this deal, we'll go along with the group conscience. Does this notion seem too cloudy? Let's all of us think back to our first AA meeting. The presence we newcomers felt in these rooms was the same as a group conscience. It was real. They welcomed us in. They didn't set up any barriers. They didn't set up any rules. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we treated each other in AA like we do that new one when they come to their first AA meeting? Yeah. I'm one of these believers that if there's anything that's a little bit gray in AA today, and there's not a darn thing wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous, period.
period. People are changing. That's all. And they've been doing that ever since AA got started. All we do in AA is widen the gates so that others come in. And don't be concerned about them. No. And so, as a result, that's back to tradition two. Now we come to a good one, tradition three. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And right to this tick of the time, that first A in that tradition still stands for alcoholics. Period. Now, AA was and is still very concerned about its own membership. In fact, when strong and heavy publicity first came our way, and even today, when there's more publicity about alcoholism than ever before, a lot of the older members became very, very scared. And they said to themselves, won't all kinds of odd people show up who have complications, alcohol mixed with pills and other things? Now, in the older days, and we don't hear it as much today anymore, they talked about that mythical character called a pure alcoholic. No complications, you understand, just a guzzler. And many of us thought we were like that ourselves. But then, when members began pouring in, then the old-timers, their worry really mounted. Said, won't there be some mighty queer people? Won't there be criminals? Won't there be social undesirables and degenerates? They asked with a certain amount of mixed amount of snobbishness and smugness. And this is nothing but downright fear. We simply do not know what or who is going to show up at AA. And you know what? Since AA has gotten started, every kind of human being that's an alcoholic has shown up in Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. Wouldn't AA be dull if it didn't have a bunch of weirdos in it? Now you say, well, isn't every organization entitled to have rules for membership? Why did AA decide to forego this privilege to be all-inclusive and not exclusive? And that's simple. Early members tried it the other way, and it just did not work. And as our fellowship was nearing its 10-year mark, the office that was then at our headquarters asked the groups to list their membership rules, and you have never lived until you've read some of the membership rules in some of these groups, and send them in. I've been to AA groups where you go in and the secretary sits at a desk. And right after opening the meeting, he opens up the roll book, and he starts calling the roll. Susie Q, here. David A. David A. David A. This is the fourth straight meeting David A. has missed. Who will volunteer to go see where David A. is? And then they'd go on and call the roll. And they preserved the roll. Yeah. And as a result of it, they list all the membership rules and send them in. And if all those rules had been enforced every place, everywhere in AA, it would have been practically impossible for any alcoholic to become a member of AA. Our two co-founders never could be members of AA if all the rules were in there. If you read Bill's story, alcohol and sedatives, and Dr. Bob, alcohol and barbiturates. And so the rule books were thrown out and replaced by one uncomplicated sentence. Tradition three, but then somebody may say, well, in this tradition itself a rule? It does state one requirement for membership. Well, let's read it again. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Well, who in AA is so designated in any group, any place, anywhere, to determine whether a newcomer qualifies, whether he or she wants to stop drinking? I've been in AA meetings and groups over half of this world, and I've never been in a group where they got an instrument where you can stick up, down, and in and through an alcoholic to see how alcoholic they are, or if they want to stop drinking. Everybody has to take the word from. This is the precise reason in Chapter 5. It says if you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to anything to get, then you are ready to take certain steps. It's up to us as an individual. We're free to come, we're free to go, we're free to stay. But most of us don't want to make the decision for ourselves, hoping that we're really not alcoholics.